On the phone with me is Ted Newman. Good afternoon, Ted.
How are you?
Good, and how are you doing today?
Well, I'm just doing fantastic, but I'm hoping to get better.
Ted, when you started out listening to music when you were just a kid, who was it you were listening to, and what kind of an influence did they have on you for the future?
Well, interestingly enough, I grew up, my mom was a pianist, an organist, my dad sang, sister sang, and so I grew up listening to all the songs of the 30s and the 40s, and then as I became a teenager, while most kids were listening to rock and roll and things like that, my favorite people were the Mills Brothers and Sammy Davis Jr. and Nat King Cole, and these were the ones that I really liked, and then I have started branching out into lots of other different types of music. I got into the rock and roll field kind of as an accident.
How was that an accident, anyway?
Well, there's a friend of mine named Jack Miller who has been one of the top recording engineers in the country for many years, but at that time he was just starting out. This was 1956, and I was getting ready to become a senior in high school, and my sister and I had recorded a couple of real low-budget commercials, and he recorded them. And just before I was ready to graduate in the spring of 1957, he called me up one day and said that he'd gone to work for a recording studio and they had a song that they wanted recorded and they were looking for some new unknown person to do it, and would I be interested? And so I went down, and that's when we recorded Plaything.
You were born and raised in Arizona?
No, I traveled around a lot. I was born in South Dakota. My father was in the Forest Service, and the Forest Service is similar to the military in that they transfer their personnel from forest to forest, you know, different districts. So I lived in South Dakota and Wyoming and Nebraska and Colorado before I came to Arizona.
But when you went to do your first recording, though, that was in Arizona?
Yes, that was in Phoenix.
So what was it like then? You get a call, they say, hey, I want you to come record this song because we've got a great song. And you go into the studio. Tell me a little bit about that experience.
Well, of course, I'd never been in a situation like that. I'd been playing the guitar for a couple of years and singing with it and doing just little things for school programs and stuff like that, but nothing professional. Been singing all my life because of my family background. And when I walked into the studio, one of the guitar players was Dwayne Eddy, who's in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Another one, it was Al Casey, who was one of the top studio recording artists on the West Coast for several years, plus some other really fine musicians and all these recording engineers and A&R men and so forth. And I was a little intimidated.
Do you remember who the ladies were that sang some of the background on that record?
No, one of them, Ruth, I might think of it later. Turned out that this one lady that was in the background, and I can't recall her name right off the bat, her brother was one of the Hilos.
I'll be darned.
And so she also was from a musical family. It was one of those things where I didn't really recognize or know any of the people, and we were just together that one time, you know. It wasn't an ongoing thing because we never performed the record live. Whenever it was done, I either lip-synced it. And the only time I ever did it live was on the Guy Mitchell TV show, and they had a studio group that backed me up on that one.
You also happened to stop by Bandstand and did the song as a lip sync on that show.
Yeah, I did that a couple of times. I think once in August and once in either September or early October of 1957. And that was probably the toughest part of the whole thing, was trying to coordinate the lip syncing, because, of course, back then it was, that's what everybody did because there was no way that they could reproduce the studio sound over the TV.
What do you remember? What stands out from the Bandstand, either of the appearances?
Well, I think the thing that I remember the most was just how nice Dick Clark was to me. He was very affable, obviously well-educated. I was young, and I had run into several different types of people in the business, if you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
And he was just a very classy guy, and I hit it off with him real well. I was also at the same time going to Arizona State on a football scholarship, and that was kind of a little different for the most of the people that were on the TV at the time, you know, for Bandstand. And my big thrust was not to be a rock and roll singer, but to get a college education.
Right. So you're on Bandstand, you do the lip sync, and you're amongst some pretty classy people. I mean, that particular week, if we go back to, say, August of 57, there's people like Elvis Presley's Teddy Bear, the Everly Brothers, Debbie Reynolds, the Coasters. Those are all some of the songs that are being played in that particular month, along with your record. That had to make you feel pretty good.
Well, you know, it did, but at the same time, if you go back to what I said earlier, I had not been a rock and roll fan, so I didn't know that much about it. I didn't know that much about Bandstand, and the music that I was really interested in was more of the ballads and the harmonic and the more musical kind of stuff, and so a lot of it didn't really sink into the people around me were a whole lot more impressed than I was.
So that record did pretty well for you. I mean, it got up to number 45 on the Billboard charts. It was on there for over 2 months, so it got some pretty substantial play all over the country.
Yeah, it did the very best in the Philly area. I think we ended up selling something like 250,000 copies. I think over 100,000 were sold right in the Philadelphia area. L.A. was another pretty good market. Those were the two really hottest places, and then it got lots of plays in other places also.
Once that thing was really hot and it was getting the plays, you had to have done some sort of touring, perhaps?
Yeah, initially, when we did the first show on Bandstand, they put me on a promotional tour back in the Midwest and the East. We started out with Bandstand, and then I think we went to three or four cities in Ohio, New Jersey, Delaware, Pennsylvania. I know we hit something like 13 or 14 cities in 9 or 10 days, and I'd never flown before, and I was doing two or three plane trips a day, and we'd rush in and do an interview with some, like Milt Grant in Chicago, and different local DJs that were big time. I remember going in to see Milt Grant, and as I was going in, Paul Anka was coming out, and we introduced ourselves to each other.
Hmm.
That was kind of interesting.
Who were some of the other people that were on that tour?
Well, the tour itself was just me on this situation. It was just a promotional tour with me and my manager, where we were doing all of the different DJ shows and some TV shows, but it was just more interviews. The only actual performance I did was what I did on Bandstand.
Mm.
And then as a result of that, I got some other opportunities, like the Guy Mitchell TV show, and I performed with Jimmy Rogers. And I don't know if you remember the Four Preps or not, but they had that song 26 Miles Across the Sea, Santa Catalina.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, interestingly enough, one of the fellows out of that group, Bruce Larson, went on to be quite a TV producer. He started out with the David Hasselhoff one about the car that was a robot.
Oh, Knight Rider.
Knight Rider, and then he did Quincy MD, and if you look at a lot of those types of shows out of that era of about 10 or 15 years, you'll see Bruce Larson's name on that. And one of the really neat people I worked with, toured with, or performed with, I should say, we weren't really on tour, because I'd just fly into L.A. and do shows with Jimmy Rogers, the one that did Honeycomb.
Mm-hmm.
And he was just a very, very nice guy. Really enjoyed knowing him.
I also read in your bio that you did some touring or some shows with Johnny Cash and Carl Perkins.
Yeah, that was kind of an interesting thing because of the strength of Plaything and the sales and so forth. Somebody came up with the idea of hooking me up with a tour that Johnny Cash was on through Texas and New Mexico and Arizona. And so they gave me my guitar and my plane ticket, and I flew down to Texas, and I walked in cold. I had no band. I had no backup, just me and the guitar trying to do Plaything, which was rather produced with all the girls and guitars and saxes and everything that was on it. And after the first show, it was kind of funny because Luther Perkins, who was one of the Tennessee Two, he played the guitar and Marshall Thompson played the bass. Luther came over to me just to back you up in your part of the show, because I was just a warm-up for Johnny Cash. Of course, Carl Perkins was on this tour, and a guy named Jimmy Newman that had a hit record in country at that time called A Falling Star.
Right.
A couple of other folks, and they could see that I was dying, so they were nice enough. Marshall and Luther backed me up. I only did a couple of three numbers to warm up, but I traveled with them for about 3 weeks, and that was an interesting experience.
I bet that was. once the run of Plaything went out, you came up with another record. And how did that come about?
Well, you know, they always try to get a quick follow-up. And what happened was there was a cover made on Plaything. Randy Wood with Dot Records got a hold of Pat Boone's brother, who sang under the name of Nick Todd.
Right.
And they did a cover of Plaything. And they had better distribution. And they started playing that song in lieu of my song, and it really wasn't a good thing, a good recording particularly. They were just, you know, at that time there were a lot of folks doing covers trying to get in on the gravy and so forth, and it just pretty much killed both of them. Plaything, both of them just tanked at that point. And then they tried to follow up with a second one called I Double Dare You, which was really kind of weak in comparison to Plaything. It was a remake of an old song, and it just didn't really work that well. And then they sold me to RCA Victor, and I did a couple of cuts with them. I'd forgotten the titles of them until I saw your website. And nothing ever really came of that. It kind of turned out that I wasn't really cut out to be the rock and roll publicity oriented type of person, and they sold me to RCA Victor and a management corporation out of New York City, and they had some things they wanted me to do to get publicity, and I wasn't quite in the frame of mind to do it.
Well, so on the I Double Dare You, then, you had pretty much the same musicians and such at the studios.
Yeah. Even when we did the records for RCA Victor, we cut them at Rev. They just came out on the RCA record. Rev was the local title. It was Ramsey Recording Studios, which later became Audio Recorders, but they used the label of Rev, R-E-V, for their company label.
Tell me something about the song Bridget. I know there's got to be a story on that one.
Well, here again, I don't know if you've ever heard it, but it's really kind of funny. I have some of those old tracks, and I was listening to one of them the other day, and of course this was at the time when Bridget Bardot was the femme fatale of the world, you know, and everybody was talking about her. And they tried to make kind of a French rock and roll song, Bridget, Bridget, ooh la la, you're the girl I'm dreaming of, or something. And, you know, somebody else might have pulled it off better than I did. It just didn't really work for me.
Well, I thought maybe after hearing that record that you had some sort of French background, but I wasn't sure.
The only French background I had was too many French fries in high school.
So you had two records on RCA. I know for a fact that I've seen a couple of CDs out there now that have included Bridget on them.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah. Do you have any kind of feel for whether they did very well in certain regions or not?
Not really. Like I say, shortly after, I was with RCA Victor for a year, and I got pretty disgruntled with the whole music business and so forth, and just kind of really lost interest in being involved, just because a lot of the extra stuff that goes on and some of the personalities that you have to deal with and so forth. And so I was just not that interested in it, and I'm not even sure if the people that wrote Plaything were the same ones that wrote Bridget or not. I know it was, Plaything was written by two brothers, the Underwood brothers. They were painting contractors, but they did music on the side, writing music and so forth. And I'm kind of thinking that maybe they wrote Bridget too, but I can't recall for sure.
Well, tell me about the folk group that you toured with in 1961.
Well, it was a fun thing. We had started out, actually, two of us and a third guy had started out in a fall semester, I believe, in 1960 at Arizona State. That's when folk music was becoming in vogue, and I had come back after spending a summer up at the Broadmoor Hotel in Colorado Springs teaching ballroom dancing. I'd made enough money to go back to college. As a sidelight, because of Plaything and my making some income off of that while I was enrolled in school, I lost my scholarship. The NCAA had a rule that you couldn't have outside sources of income while you were enrolled and attending classes. course, the really good players got money anyway, but that's okay. That's another story. But we started this trail. We did, you know, folk songs, Kingston Trail and so forth, and Blind Lighters. And just before Christmas, a bunch of us were sitting around at one of the local coffee shops on campus, and we're talking about some guys that had bummed around Europe. And we said, well, we ought to do that. Let's go bum around Europe. Well, of course, about 30 guys were all for it. Ended up that there were only two of us that really were halfway serious, because we probably weren't making our grades anyway. So we said, yeah, let's do it. You know, it's a once-in-a-lifetime deal. Let's do it, and so forth. And so, but there was only two of us. The third guy was a definite no. And so there was another fellow that sang with us in the concert choir at Arizona State, and we approached him. He was interested. So we kind of put it together and did a few rehearsals and sold all our earthly goods, which gave us enough money to each buy a one-way boat ticket and have about $100 left over, and we took off for Europe. And we ended up staying for, well, together we were there for about 6.5 months, and I stayed on for about another month and a half or so before I got called back because of the Berlin Wall. I received my draft notice and came back and went into the service. But it was fun. We entertained a lot in Spain. We did a recording in Spain. We worked with, oddly enough, a very famous French entertainer named Sacha Distel, which was one of Brigitte Bardot's former boyfriends. I don't know if that's fate or kismet or what. And then we went into Germany. We found that we had our best customers and so forth was in the service bases, because these guys were wanting to hear the American music and so forth. And then when I went on by myself, I had some interesting experiences working with some coal miners up in a little town called Gelsenkirchen, right outside of Cologne, Germany. And, you know, I'd go to the little beer stubes and pull out my guitar and make my dinner for the evening, libations.
What was the name of your group when you were all together?
Well, it depends where we were. Depends when the rent was due. We started out as the Bachelors Three. Then in Spain, we decided we'd call that the Los Tres Solteros, and that had kind of a negative connotation to it. So then we thought we would change their name to the Vagabonds, and in Spain it was Los Vagabundos. And so that's pretty much what we stayed with, was the Vagabonds. And of course, there was an American group by that name also, but we figured we wouldn't run into them over in Europe.
Probably
and if
not.
If we did, we'd just go back to being the Bachelors Three.
So fast forwarding then just a little bit, I understand you played bass for John Denver.
Yeah, that was kind of an interesting thing too. I had just gotten off of active duty in the Army, and let's see, I was flying helicopters and airplanes for the Arizona National Guard, and that was my only source of income, and I wanted to get back into music at that point. And there was a folk house out in Scottsdale that brought semi-known acts in, not the really big ones, but still ones that were on the upward swing, and they needed a bass player. The guy said that he'd heard me do my single with just me and the guitar, and he really liked that, and he said that he'd like to have me be the regular warm-up act, but he needed somebody that could play bass for groups that needed it. And he asked me if I could play bass, and I said, well, sure, I can play bass. He says, okay, you're hired. And so I quick ran out and called a friend of mine that gave bass lessons, and I went and rented a bass and took a couple of bass lessons, and then locked myself in the bedroom for the weekend and got my hands all bloodied. But Monday night I opened playing bass for John Denver. And that summer I played a total of about 5 or 6 weeks for him. And I was playing bass for him the night that he got the call to replace Chad Mitchell in the Mitchell Trio, which was his really big step up.
Mm-hmm.
And it was from there on that he, of course, just came out with a couple of songs for Peter, Paul, and Mary, and then he hit with Country Road, and like
right.
I say, the rest was history.
There was an LP that you did called I've Been to Town. Tell me about that.
Well, this was, again, a little after I'd played for John. And for several years, I worked just as a single in the Scottsdale area. I spent about a year over in California. And I decided I wanted to do a album, and was able to scrape together some money for it. And of course, I've Been to Town was one of Glenn Yarbrough's big songs by Rod McEwen, and I always loved McEwen's music and Yarbrough's voice. And this was just a compendium of a bunch of current folk songs of the day. There was nothing, I hadn't started writing then. The only thing interesting about that album is that the guy that played the lead guitar on it for me was a fellow named Billy Williams, and Billy subsequently became a producer, and he won the Grammy for Lyle Lovett's Road to Ensenada a few years back, and he's very highly respected in the business. He does all of the production work and sound work for Lyle Lovett.
I always like to ask what you're doing now, and I think that there's an awful lot of things that you're doing now, but maybe you can give us a synopsis of the kinds of things that you're into.
I retired from teaching about 4 years ago. I didn't start teaching until late in life, and I taught for 20 years and retired, golly, I guess it's been 4 years ago. And before I retired, I had started going up to Colorado in the summertime and entertaining for cowboy cookouts. Part of my background has been working with horses and ranches and stuff like that over the years, and I love good cowboy music, and I have written a lot of it along with jazz and everything else. But anyhow, I had started going up there in the summer times and teaching here in the winter times and entertaining in the local area. While I was teaching, I started writing a lot of songs. I've got over 400 copyrights, and about 40 or 50 of those songs are songs that I wrote for my students in my classroom. Ended up my last few years teaching fifth grade. One song in particular was a song I wrote called The Great Sonoran Desert, which teaches the kids about this desert that we live in here in Arizona that starts in the Mexican state of Sonora and is, of course, symbolized by the giant saguaro cactus. This is the only place in the world that it grows. I was guesting an artist in residence one day, and I shared this song with him, and he listened to it. He said, "Would you mind if I illustrated this?" I said, "Shoot, no." So he did some beautiful drawings of it, watercolors, and what it does, it talks about all the different critters of the desert and why the desert's a neat place, and it's just a fun educational way to look at with music at the desert. Well, we went ahead and had it published. We published it ourselves about 2.5 years ago, I guess, and along with some other songs about Arizona that teach about the history and geography and culture and so forth. I have a program that I take into schools. I've been at all over here in the valley and over in New Mexico and up in Colorado that teaches kids about the Sonoran Desert, teaches about the Southwest, and just generally uses music as an educational device. So I do that, then I entertain at the Broadmoor Hotel for cowboy cookouts and things up in Colorado Springs and Garden of the Gods, and then there's a guest ranch called the Mule Creek Outfitters that has a Friday and Saturday night cowboy steak fry and dinner show, and I'm the dinner show.
And you have several CDs to your credit as well.
I have maybe 6 or 7 CDs that I have done, and I just finished one with a really super bass player, a guy who used to play bass for Dottie West. His name's Danny Shannon, and we just finished a CD that has two or three of standard songs on it, and then several of my originals. This one has more guitar instrumentals and so forth on it.
So if somebody was interested in buying a CD, where would they go?
I don't even have a website. You know, if you're familiar with the record stores and things like that, there's just no way that a small person like me can get into those markets. And basically, I do most of my sales at point of sale. I mean, if somebody wanted to email me, I could mail them one through the mail, but they'd certainly want to be able to hear it first and so forth, and I wouldn't expect anybody to buy something cold. So I kind of depend on when I do my shows. I probably do at least 100 to 120 shows a year, and that point of sale is probably the most productive at the level that I'm at.
What about a place like CD Baby online?
I've got one of my CDs there called Where Does Love Go, which was the first CD that I recorded, and It is available on CD Baby.
Well, is there anything that you want to mention that that I may have missed that you'd like people to know about you?
Gee, I can't think of anything. I appreciate you taking the time to contact. I thought it was really fun to look up and see these things on the website when I sent you that email. I'm still very, very active. I've got 13 grandkids and one great-grandkid and a wonderful wife and a beautiful yellow Labrador retriever, and I get to sing in Arizona in the wintertime and Colorado in the summertime and get to Hawaii a couple times a year, so it's really hard to find too much to be unhappy about.
That sounds pretty good to me.
Yeah, you know, if you work long enough and hard enough, like I tell my wife, since I've quit teaching, the music, of course, has been getting more and more every year, and I tell her, by the time I'm 90, I'm going to be booked solid.
Well, Ted, thanks a lot for taking time with me as well to do the interview and to bring us up to date and give us some pretty interesting details about what happened back in the later 50s up through today.
It's like one of the songs that I've written. It's called Oh, What a Ride We've Had.